This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Well, welcome to the 2010 Keynes Lecture, organised by Robinson College. My name is Mark Hayes, and I am Fellow in Economics at Robinson, and also Secretary of the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, which has sponsored tonight's lecture. This is really an extension of the Keynes seminar, which takes place every other Tuesday in Robinson College, but usually we only expect a dozen or so, and I thought we might need a bit more room tonight. For the benefit of those unable to attend, the lecture is being recorded and will be available on the PKSG website, www.postkeynesian.net, along with previous talks to the seminar. It is a strange turn of events that nowadays, here in Cambridge of all places, we are told that Keynesian economics is the economics of sticky prices. We are told that the basic division in macroeconomics is between the long run and the short run, between a classical model in which prices are flexible under competition, and a Keynesian model, in which prices, including wages, are sticky, so that the forces of competition are unable to clear markets and bring about full employment. Because, it is said, Keynes gives no good reason for this stickiness, and is guilty of ad hoc theorising, a so-called New Keynesian economics has been developed, which offers explanations for the short-run failure of prices and wages to adjust in terms of individual economic behaviour. Mankiw, who of course wrote one of our Part 1 texts, wrote that if New Keynesian economics is not a true representation of Keynes's views, so much the worse for Keynes. Now, if Keynes's ashes had not been scattered on the downs, we can be sure that he would be spinning in his grave. So different is the economics of Keynes from its caricature that it has been expelled from the curriculum, although the stature of Keynes remains such that it has not been possible to expel him from the pantheon. And indeed, in policy circles, his name reappeared overnight, in late 2008. But whether recent events will have a similar impact on economic theory and long-term policy is quite another matter, and is indeed fundamentally uncertain. In these circumstances, I can think of no better speaker than Professor Lord Robert Skidelsky to convey the true nature of Keynes's thinking on economics and other matters. Furthermore, Lord Skidelsky, like Lord Keynes himself, is more than an economist. He describes himself as an economically literate historian, and this does, I think, give a particularly helpful perspective, not only on Keynes, but on the present state of economics. So please welcome Lord Skidelsky.
Thank you very much for that introduction. When I finished my biography of Keynes in 2001, his star seemed to have faded. Despite a medley of new Keynesians, post-Keynesians, synthesizers, eclectics, trimmers, and occasional outbreaks of common sense by policymakers, the dominant tendency in theory and policy was being set by the Chicago School. Their new classical economics was simply a mathematically souped-up version of the old classical economics, which Keynes had overthrown in the 1930s. Markets were deemed to be optimally self-regulating. The macroeconomic task of government was restricted to maintaining sound money, and government's task in the microeconomy was to free up markets in order to lower the natural rate of unemployment. The fall of communism, of course, in 1990 made possible globalization, the worldwide extension of the market system. Recent events have brought Keynes back to life. The so-called Great Moderation, which seemed to vindicate the deregulated market system, lasted less than 10 years. And from today's perspective, it looks nothing so much like as the Roaring Twenties, which preceded the Great Depression of 1929 to 32. With the financial collapse of 2007 to 2008, the new classical belief in the self-regulating market has proved to be as illusory as the old classical belief. But since I wrote my biography, I finished it in 2001, my ideas of what was significant in Keynes have shifted, partly because the world has changed. What I want to do this evening is to indicate the topics which I think have gained importance, and which a contemporary Keynesian should be most concerned with. And I've selected five of these. The role of uncertainty, the debate over the stimulus, the reform of the international monetary system, a new Keynesian political economy, and finally, the state of economics. Economics has got into a completely disgusting state, and what are we going to do about it? So I'll deal with each of them in turn. I may have to leave one out on the way. I may have too little time. But first of all, and most importantly, the role of uncertainty. I would now assign a much greater weight to uncertainty in Keynes's thinking than I did when I wrote my book, my biography. It was not that I was unaware of uncertainty, but I didn't place it at the heart of my account of Keynes's theory. In this, I followed the conventional interpretation, really. The purpose of the general theory was to explain how an economy could get stuck in a low employment trap, not how it had got there. In other words, it was an equilibrium theory. This seemed the right model for the time, because the world wanted to know how to get out of the trap. The theory of the multiplier showed how much extra demand needed to be pumped into a depressed economy to bring it back to full employment. The income expenditure model was thus the bit of Keynes most suitable for policymakers. Very important, in the general theory, expectations were taken as given. Aggregate demand was simply expected income. But why one level of income was expected rather than another was not explained. But any theory of an economy moving through time has to have a theory of expectations. And that's where Keynes's theory of uncertain expectations comes in. What causes economies to collapse is the existence of, ultimately, the existence of uncertain expectations. Uncertain expectations enter the plot of the general theory only after Keynes had stated the positive part of his theory, which, as I say, assumes given expectations. Yet it's obvious, I think, that without uncertain expectations, there'd be no plot. The collapse of investment, which drives the economy into a slump, would not happen. Indeed, interest rates would automatically rebalance any discrepancy between ex-ante saving and investment. And the classical theory would be the relevant one under all circumstances. Yet, what was a digression, Keynes called it a digression in the general theory, became the central message when he came to write an article entitled The General Theory of Employment, published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics in February 1937. So my interpretation of Keynes, like that of the post-Keynesians, draws heavily on that 1937 article, not completely, but draws heavily on it. And I think that's the right interpretation of Keynes for today. Many commentators have assumed that Keynes had nothing to say about financial instability. This is wrong. The instability of investment as a cause of crisis is a continuing theme in his writings. It goes all the way back to the Tract on Monetary Reform. You can find it in the Treatise on Money. And also you can find clearly stated its cause, the cause of the instability of investment, namely inescapable uncertainty about the future. And equally clearly, Keynes identifies a predictable knowledge of the future as the key tacit assumption behind the classical theory of the self-regulating market. If we knew what tomorrow would bring, there would never, never, assuming rational behavior, be a financial crisis. Or there might be some sort of disturbance if there was an exogenous shock, but the economy would be very swiftly self-correcting. Keynes's view that uncertainty about the future is the root cause of financial crisis may be contrasted with today's view that the recent banking collapse was caused by the, I quote, mispricing of risk. Behind this lies the notion that risks can be correctly priced, but that something impeded markets from discovering these correct prices. Either there'd be information or incentive failures, or there'd be some shocks that hit the system which needed time to correct. And therefore, better risk management by the banks and by the regulators is needed. More transparency, better risk models, and above all, better incentives to evaluate correctly the risks being run. That's the way the reform talk goes. The argument seems to be between those who say risks are always correctly priced, the efficient market hypothesis, and those who concede that imperfect information or shocks and wrong incentives can cause market prices to deviate from the correct prices given by fundamentals for some period, but the asset bubbles collapse because they're bubbles. By contrast, Keynes made a key distinction between risk and uncertainty. Risk is when probabilities can be known, measured. Uncertainty exists when they can't be. His original insight was that the classical theory of the self-regulating market rested on the epistemological claim that market participants have perfect information about future events. It's interesting that rational expectations was already there implicitly in classical economics. It's just been made explicit by new classical economics. Grant this, and the full employment assumption is the best one to make. Deny it, and it collapses. Keynes's economy, on the other hand, is one in which our knowledge of the future is usually very slight and often negligible, and expectations are frequently subject to disappointment. That means that classical economics is a peculiarly unsuitable subject for the theory of how wealth accumulates because of its perfect knowledge assumption. Models which assume that we have calculable probabilities for many things are simply fraudulent prospectuses. What was it that rendered large parts of the future impervious to probabilistic calculations? One of my favorite examples from Keynes is one he gives of an apple endowed with human characteristics. Newtonian physics tells us that the apple will always fall to the ground at a speed dictated by the force exerted on it divided by its mass. But no such prediction can be made about the human apple. And Keynes writes, "It is as though the fall of the apple to the ground depended on the apple's motives, on whether it is worthwhile falling to the ground, and whether the ground wanted the apple to fall, and on mistaken calculations on the part of the apple on how far it was from the center of the earth." Now, some part of the uncertainty attaching to the speed of the apple's fall can be put down to mistakes on the apple's part, mistaken calculations, which are in principle correctable by the apple. But the main human characteristics with which Keynes endows his apple is motives and intentions. It is these which break the link between economics and physics, and which make economics a moral and not a natural science. Keynes's point is that economics deals with introspection and values, with motives, expectations, psychological uncertainties. The future can't be predicted because the future is unpredictably changeable. It is unpredictably changeable in large part because it is what we choose to make it. And this view, incidentally, implies a large restriction on the applicability of econometrics. Basically, Keynes believed that econometrics could be applied only to those fields in which risk is measurable. And that, of course, excludes many of the risks incurred in investment markets. The main technique we adopt to cope with an uncertain universe is to give risk numbers. That is what mathematical forecasting models do, using in many cases some version of Bayes' theorem to transform prior into posterior probabilities. And this gives us the assurance we need to invest. But it's a fake assurance. While repeated betting on horses allows you to update your priors to match the true merits of the horses, no amount of data on past economic events brings you any closer to their true likelihood of occurring in the future, because the future is bound to be different from the past. What we do is to use mathematics to invent a world of calculable probabilities which we take to be the real world. Thinking about the future as calculable is compatible with a considerable measure of stability. Mathematical forecasts can shape the future they claim to predict by shaping our expectations. They may produce what economists call bootstraps equilibria, paths which are what they are not because the world is what it is, but because beliefs about it are what they are. So you start from this epistemological foundation, or Keynes does, and then asks, what is it that causes investment to break down? His answer is that the technique for transforming uncertainty into calculable risk rests on a convention, and I'm quoting here, that the existing state of affairs will continue indefinitely, except insofar as we have specific reasons to expect a change in the near future. We are assuming, in effect, that the existing market valuation, however arrived at, is uniquely correct in relation to our existing knowledge and will only change in proportion to a change in that knowledge. This convention, though, is philosophically flawed, since our existing knowledge does not provide a sufficient basis for calculable mathematical expectation. Nevertheless, by using the convention, the investor can legitimately encourage himself with the idea that the only risk he runs is that of a genuine change in the news over the near future, which is unlikely to be very large. Thus, investment becomes reasonably safe for the individual investor over short periods, and hence over a succession of short periods, if he can fairly rely on there being no breakdown in the convention. And Keynes believed that it's been on some such basis as this that stock markets have been developed. But the flaw in the method is I think, obvious. It abstracts from uncertainty by assuming that the future will be a succession of very short periods, for each of which we can expect to have reliable information. In practice, the prospective yield, discounted future cash flow of an investment over a number of years, is subject to all kinds of unknowns about future events. The future of interest rates, inflation rates, exchange rates, choice of interest rates for discounting, and so on. The assumption of the efficient market hypothesis that all the relevant information about the future price of securities is already present in their current prices is as heroic as is the belief that fundamental analysis will give us reliable information about the future course of microeconomic and macroeconomic variables. The first fails to explain how current prices can diverge from their so-called intrinsic values, and the second assumes knowledge about things about which there's no scientific basis to form any calculable probability whatsoever. Contrary to the current orthodoxy that expectations are realized on average, Keynes believed them to be quite likely to be disappointed on average, with rare moments of satisfaction. And he also believed that uncertainty forced professional investment into speculation, since no one can afford to be left holding the bad penny when the music stops. Well, expectations so precariously based are liable to be swept away, because, as Keynes says, there's no firm basis of conviction to hold them steady. That is, no firm basis of conviction that enables us to distinguish between noise and genuine changes in the information. Suddenly, everyone starts revising his bets. The practice of calmness and immobility, of certainty and security, suddenly breaks down. New fears and hopes will, without warning, take charge of human conduct. The forces of disillusion may suddenly impose a new conventional basis of valuation. All these pretty polite techniques made for well-panelled boardrooms and a nicely regulated market collapse. And that, to my mind, is as good a theoretical account as I know for the meltdown of autumn 2008. However, the story is only half told. Investment depends on what Keynes calls the marginal efficiency of capital. Roughly, the expected rate of return over cost compared to the rate of interest. Now, if the MEC, the marginal efficiency of capital, is greater than the rate of interest, investment takes place. If it's less, it stops. In the classical picture, the rate of interest, being the price which equilibrates saving and investment, adjusts automatically to any change in profit expectations. Keynes accepted that the volume of investment depends on the rate of interest, but he denied that the rate of interest was determined in the market for saving and investment. Rather, it is the price for parting with money. This is his liquidity preference theory of the rate of interest. Money plays a key part in Keynes's narrative of investment breakdown. Holding money is an alternative to buying investments. And I think Keynes was the first economist who brought out the significance. He wasn't the first economist to notice. First economist to bring out the macroeconomic significance of money as a store of value. What he called liquidity preference rises when the convention supporting investment collapses. A rise in liquidity preference can retard the fall in the rate of interest necessary to bring about a recovery investment in face of an expected fall in profitability. Indeed, a fall in the expected profitability of investment and a flight into money are just two sides of the same coin. And that's essentially what happened in 2007, 2008. Liquidity suddenly dried up as banks enlarged their cash balances and stopped lending. Indebtedness played a larger part in the freeze-up than it did during the time of the Great Depression. That's obviously true. But the essential motive for the flight into money, loss of confidence in the future, was the same. Any rise in the demand for money to hold tends to raise the cost of borrowing at the precise moment when the fall in the expected profitability of investment requires the cost of borrowing to fall. And Keynes's liquidity preference of the theory of the rate of interest is his main explanation for why a market economy lacks an automatic self-regulating mechanism. He uses uncertainty again to explain something else, something that this has been very ignored in the literature. Mark Hayes alluded to it, and that is sticky wages. The question is, why does not competition between workers bid down wages sufficiently for all to find jobs? Or to put it another way, how can Keynes's underemployment equilibrium be a real equilibrium if it contains disequilibrium prices? A major theoretical weakness of the post-war Keynesians was their inability to explain persisting unemployment except in terms of sticky prices, and their inability to explain why prices are sticky. Axel Leeuwenhoek goes some way to filling this theoretical gap, in my view, within a non-Keynesian long-period full employment framework. As he points out, the main innovation of the general theory was to create a model in which the system reacts to disturbance by quantity and not by price adjustments. Following a shock, output and prices both adjust, but prices adjust slower than output, because people don't know what the new equilibrium price is. So they trade at disequilibrium prices. There's no auctioneer to establish a vector of market clearing prices before trade starts. Further, only in the very long run need only in very long run need long-term interest rates conform to underlying physical transformation possibilities and intertemporal household preferences. Uncertainty may thus cause real wages and long-term interest rates to remain for years above the rate needed for full employment. So I think in all these ways, uncertainty really does sort of play a vital part in Keynes's explanation of why things go wrong. And I think we miss all that dimension in recent discussions of the slump. Now, my second topic is the debate about the stimulus. When the financial system crashed in 2008, dragging down the real economy with it, government stepped in everywhere with stimulus packages made up of a mixture of printing money, providing tax rebates or subsidies for private spending, and, of course, big increases in loan finance, public spending. And this was all according to the Keynesian prescription. Even Robert Lucas, high priest of Chicago economics, admitted that we're all Keynesians in the foxhole. Although he never explained why we were in the foxhole to start with, which would have been really impossible if his theories were true. But signs of economic recovery induced by the stimulus rapidly brought about a resumption of normal intellectual service. Most economists and many policymakers are now calling for a swift withdrawal of the stimulus on the ground that it will bankrupt governments or lead to inflation or both. What this rapid turnabout shows is that the model of the economy, which Keynes had hoped to blast out of the mind of economists in the early 1930s, is still firmly lodged there. That is a model of an economy that is always at or very rapidly recovers full employment if shocked. This model wavers in moments of panic, but quickly reasserts itself. In fact, the current debate about the stimulus is an exact replay of the debate between Keynes and his critics at the time of the Great Depression. What changes in economics? Well, just a bit of history. In 1929, when British unemployment was 10% of the insured workforce, Keynes and Hubert Henderson wrote a pamphlet entitled, Can Lloyd George Do It? And in this, they proposed a big program of public works to be financed by loan, the idea being to create a cumulative wave of prosperity. The British Treasury, playing its familiar role, attempted to refute the proposal using an argument developed by its then-only economist, Ralph Hawtrey. Hawtrey had claimed that with a fixed money supply, any loan raised by the government for public works would crowd out an equivalent amount of private spending. Employment could be increased only by credit expansion, or what was then called inflation. And the Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, was fed the lines, we must either take existing money or print new money. And Keynes had a brilliant riposte to that. He said, Mr. Baldwin has invented the formidable argument that you must not do anything because it means you will not be able to do anything else. Yet, the Treasury argument was restated in 2009 in almost identical terms by Professor John Cochran of Chicago University. And I want to quote from him. If money is not going to be printed, it has to come from somewhere. If the government borrows a dollar from you, that is a dollar that you do not spend, or that you do not lend to a company to spend on new investment. Every dollar of increased government spending must correspond to one less dollar of private spending. Jobs created by stimulus spending are offset by jobs from the decline of private spending. We can build roads instead of factories, but fiscal stimulus can't help us to build more of both. Now, the policy implication of that argument is that the fiscal stimulus was a mistake and should be withdrawn as soon as possible in order to create room for private spending. And that is, in fact, what George Osborne has been saying for the last several months. And this has been, now, this would be correct, this view, this call not having a stimulus or removing the stimulus, if the economy were at full employment. But coming at a point when production and employment had fallen by 5%, it is plainly nonsensical. Government spending to put the unemployed to work is not taking away employment from those already in work. It is adding to the amount of employment. But it's a bit more complicated than that, because it's equally obvious that increased government spending will have to be financed initially by printing money, because any fall in aggregate spending will have led to a fall in the money supply. But as the new money is spent, there will be extra dollars for the government to borrow without taking it away from the owners of existing dollars. Keynes explained all this clearly in 1937, when he pointed out that an investment decision may involve a temporary demand for money before the corresponding saving has taken place. In this situation, the central bank could always create the finance for additional investment, private or public, by printing more money. And if that investment takes place, there will be a rise in national income which will be exactly sufficient to pay for the new investment. And I mean, that's the argument which I think people accepted until the new classical economists came along muddy the waters. Now, there are lots of contemporary Hawtreians around, people who believe that Hawtrey won his argument against Keynes. One of the most prominent in this country is Tim Congdon, and I keep having rows with him about this. And he's a clever guy, but he is a Hawtreyan. He believes that, in fact, quantitative easing is sufficient to bring about recovery, to bring about a revival of private spending. There's no need for any fiscal stimulus at all. When the central government buys government and corporate securities, it adds to the cash reserves of banks and companies. These purchases enable banks to expand their deposits, loans, and companies to expand their investments. So open market operations, carried out to any extent necessary, will be sufficient to produce recovery even from a severe slump. Well, Keynes certainly believed something like this when he wrote the Treatise on Money. Monetary policy, he thought, would be sufficient to rescue an economy from a slump, except in the exceptional circumstance when the expectation of profit had fallen below the bond rate. And in 1932, he thought this circumstance had come to pass. And I quote this 1932 passage because it was before the general theory was written, and he went on to develop his liquidity trap theory, really, from this insight. "It may still be the case," he said, "that the lender, with his confidence shattered by his experience, will continue to ask for new enterprise rates of interest which the borrower cannot expect to earn. If this proves to be the case, there will be no means of escape from prolonged and perhaps interminable depression except by direct state intervention to promote and subsidize new investment. Well, the liquidity trap, the long Japanese stagflation of the 1990s brought into prominence this sort of submerged idea in Keynes that there was a liquidity trap. Chapter 13 of the General Theory tried to answer the question why someone should hold money for any purpose other than the transactions and precautionary motives, three motives he identified for holding money. After all, by holding bonds rather than money, one obtains an income, the rate of interest, which is the reward for parting with liquidity. Keynes found the necessary condition for such a speculative money holding in the existence of uncertainty as to the future rate of interest. If the rates of interest ruling in the future could be foreseen with certainty, it must always be advantageous to purchase a debt rather than to hold cash. However, if the future rates of interest were uncertain, the outcome could be quite different. If interest rates and bond yields were expected to rise, a capital loss would be suffered, with the loss being higher than the more long-dated, is the bond. And Keynes warned that for an investor thinking of acquiring a bond with a life of N years, I'm quoting, if a need to liquid cash may conceivably arise before the expiry of N years, there is a risk of loss being incurred in purchasing a long-term debt and subsequently turning it into cash as compared with holding cash. So his conclusion was that when there were enough investors who expected the next move in interest rates to be upwards, they would hold at least part of their wealth in the form of money rather than bonds. And they would do this even if they would be foregoing income in the immediate future. And so open market operations under those circumstances wouldn't rescue the economy. Only fiscal policy would. Now, Keynes didn't believe that a pure liquidity trap, in the sense that the LM curve is completely flat, had ever arisen, though he thought that the United States in the early 1930s had started to approximate to that position. But clearly, any flattening of the LM curve, even if short of a trap, reduces the effectiveness of monetary policy. Of course, Keynes didn't really mind a flat LM curve, because while monetary policy would, under those circumstances, be disabled, the government would be able to borrow unlimited amounts at a nominal rate of interest for its own spending. So this is all in Chapter 13 and Chapter 15 of the General Theory. Keynes's liquidity trap discussion has been heavily criticized for being analytically incomplete. He postulated only two alternatives, holding cash or buying bonds. But savers may express their desire for liquidity by increasing their demand for other liquid assets, such as equities. If investors have a choice between money, bonds, and equities, and you also allow an increase in the quantity of money to alter inflation expectations, Keynes's liquidity trap tends to disintegrate. However, this does not, it seems to me, rescue the case for monetary policy as a sufficient cure for a slump. Quantitative easing has undoubtedly had a positive effect on stock market prices. Most of it has not yet filtered through into the real economy, because I think the so-called wealth effect, which comes out of a stock market boom, has a very, very weak and uncertain multiplier. The government has bid up prices, quantitative easing has bid up prices of existing assets, but not stimulated new investment, because lenders are still asking more from borrowers than borrowers can expect to earn. The general proposition is that a dearth of that the emergence of asset bubbles, just as much as a flight into money, can signal a dearth of investment opportunities. And one should have been alerted to that by Keynes's description of his third motive as the speculative motive for holding money. His speculative motive should not be confused simply with a desire to hold cash. Current rescue policy, while current recovery policy, while it has been based largely on printing money, has had a very partial success. It has stopped the slide into another Great Depression, but has produced such an anemic recovery that we are in danger of a double-dip recession. Now, I come to my third topic, but I want to curtail this because, although I think it's very, very important, I'm not going to have time to deal with it, and that is his plan, the topic of global imbalances. Keynes's 1941 plan for an international clearing union was designed to overcome the global imbalances of his day, namely the blocking of balance of payments adjustment by the tendency of the United States, it was then, to accumulate gold reserves, which imposed deflation on the rest of the world. Well, there's then a long, long story. His clearing union was defeated. It was vetoed by the United States. Nevertheless, this veto by the United States on Keynes's plan to redistribute, to have a more symmetric payments adjustment system, didn't prove fatal because of the dishoarding policies of the United States. America flooded the free world with dollars to such an extent that by the 1960s it was starting to run a balance of trade deficit itself. The boot was now, so to speak, on the other foot. But the logic of the deficit country having to deflate was bypassed by the role of the dollar as the world's main reserve asset. In his book, Indian Currency and Reform, Keynes, Indian Currency and Finance, which was written as early as 1913, Keynes had endorsed the gold exchange standard as being in the forefront of monetary evolution. Broadly speaking, That book envisaged one or two countries only being on the gold standard, with the rest of the world holding their reserves in these currencies, which, because of their convertibility into gold, were as good as gold. As sterling faded as a reserve currency, only 4% of the world's reserves are now held in sterling, compared to 30% in 1950. As sterling faded as a reserve currency, the dollar became the world's key currency, and countries started to hold their reserves in dollars. And of course, this system broke down for because of a flaw which was described in the late 60s by Professor Triffin of Yale University. And so one thought, well, the era of these national reserve currencies was now going to be over. We'd be on a world of floating exchange rates. In theory, if everyone floats, you don't need any reserves. But of course, everyone didn't float, and so you had a mixed system. And in the 1990s, the appetite for large reserves unexpectedly revived, mainly to guard against speculative movements of hot money, which could drive exchange rates away from their equilibrium values. And in the 1990s, especially after the 1997-1998 East Asian financial crisis, East Asian governments unilaterally erected a Bretton Woods II, linking their currencies to the dollar and holding their reserves in dollar. This reproduced the expansionary benefits of Bretton Woods I, but also led to an increasingly unbalanced reserve position as the dollar became progressively overvalued against the East Asian currencies. A Keynesian analysis would put global imbalances at the heart of the current economic meltdown. Keynesian unemployment is triggered off by an imbalance between saving and investment. That's what everyone is taught, which is liquidated, that imbalance, by a fall in output. The imbalance can be initiated either by an increased desire to save or a reduced desire to invest, or by a combination of both. Assume a closed economy, as Keynes did, and then postulate the following. An increased desire to save by the Chinese, unmatched by an increased U.S. desire to invest, subjected the American economy to a deflationary pressure. This was offset by an inflow of dollars invested in U.S. Treasury bonds, which enabled Alan Greenspan to keep the Fed funds rate abnormally low. But the ensuing credit expansion resulted not in a surge in investment, but in the build-up of debt-fueled private asset and consumption. The situation was unsustainable because not enough new resources were being created in this boom to pay back either the domestic or foreign borrowing. And between 2004 and 2006, the Federal Reserve Board, seeking to dampen inflation and cut off the asset boom and return short-term interest rates to a more normal level, raised its fund rate from 1% to 5.25% and held it there until August 2007. This brought about a collapse in the housing boom, and through its repercussions on the balance sheets of the banks, which had provided or securitized housing mortgages of the banking system. And Keynes had explained how this would happen very, very clearly when he was dealing with the British banking crisis of 1914. If A owes B money and B owes it to C and C to D and so on, the failure of A may involve the failure of the whole series. And this is not unlike what happened in the run-up to the Great Depression. Now my fourth topic, Keynes's political economy. At present, the reform agenda for averting future crises concentrates entirely on reforming or restructuring the banking system to prevent imprudent lending. These reforms are very necessary, and I applaud President Obama's recent call for a separation of investment and retail banking. But there's a common assumption that once the crisis is over, macroeconomic policy can continue as before, that is, with a single target, the inflation rate. However, even after you've reformed the banking system, and by no means are these reforms secured, there will continue to exist many risks which cannot be properly managed because they are unmeasurable. So part of the risk reduction role has to be assumed by the government. This implies an enlargement of the present macroeconomic functions of government. Keynes's recipe for a less uncertain economy had three main planks: measures to stimulate investment, measures to stimulate consumption, and a reform of the international monetary system to prevent the transmission of unemployment from one country to another. The first duty of the state is to ensure enough investment in the economy to maintain continuous full employment. Although cutting taxes might give a temporary boost to investment, it will only have a weak and uncertain effect on profit expectations. And for the same, and for reasons I've already described, Keynes didn't rely on monetary policy. He didn't think that would be sufficient to maintain a continuous full employment level, because he thought that it might be impossible to get the rate of interest down sufficiently. So what he thought was, though, that, you know, the government should do all it could on the interest rate front and try and establish over time a convention that interest rates would be kept permanently low. He believed that long-term interest rates should be kept low. He did not believe in the use of interest rate policy to manage the cycle, because he thought that once they'd gone up and people had decided that a normal rate of interest was higher than the rate needed to maintain full employment, it would be difficult to get them down again. So he wanted them to be kept continuously low, and that would certainly be a help. But he placed his main emphasis on the socialization of investment, as he called it. And he wrote, "I expect to see the state taking an even greater responsibility for directly organizing investment." And again, this is in the general theory, which doesn't have much about policy. "I conceive, therefore, that a somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment will prove the only means of securing an approximation to full employment." These are well-known phrases, and he's been attacked as a rabid socialist because he suggested that the state might play a bigger part in the investment process. By socialization of investment, Keynes didn't mean nationalization. He actually was against nationalization. He wasn't in favor of nationalization. Socialization of investment need not exclude, and I quote, "all manners of compromise and devices by which public authority will cooperate with private initiative." This single throwaway line in the general theory reflects his thinking on public-private partnerships, which come out of his involvement in liberal politics in the 1920s. In essence, he sought to expand the public utility component of investment to give greater stability to the investment function. Today he would have seen the big institutional investors, like pension funds, as a major support for stability. A guaranteed stream of investment would reduce business fluctuations to much more limited amounts, about which he wasn't quite honestly that concerned. Provided the fluctuations could be limited, he didn't really mind. What he wanted to avoid was these severe states of persisting mass unemployment. And of course, he would have accepted that state investment would be inefficient, that it wouldn't yield the maximum possible profits which private investment claimed to do. But there would be a gain if markets. But on the other hand, with uncertainty, there is a gain against having no state investment at all because of the losses which private markets make due to uncertainty. So you always have to weigh the two inefficiencies together, two sets of potential losses, and decide in your own mind which one you want to suffer. Keynes's political economy would also use the taxation system to redistribute income, since an increase in the habitual tendency to consume will, in general, that's except in conditions of full employment, serve to increase the inducement to invest. The rationale for this, of course, is well known. The poor spend a higher proportion of their incomes than do the rich. And I think the best quote I've got on the logic of income redistribution comes not from Keynes, but from someone who you may not have heard of, Mariner Eccles, who was chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve Board from 1934 to 1948. And I just want to quote it because it seems to me to sum up the logic very well. A mass production economy has to be accompanied by mass consumption. Mass consumption, in turn, implies a distribution of wealth to provide men with buying power. Instead of achieving that kind of distribution, a giant suction pump had by 1929 drawn into a few hands an increasing proportion of currently produced wealth. This served them as capital accumulation. But by taking purchasing power out of the hands of mass consumers, the savers denied to themselves the kind of effective demand for their products that would justify a reinvestment of their capital accumulation in new plants. In consequence, as in a poker game, when the chips are concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, the other fellows can stay in the game only by borrowing. When their credit runs out, the game stops. And the same suction pump was in operation in Britain and the United States in the run-up to the 2007 crisis. Access to credit, compensating for the growing inequality in wealth and incomes. Finally, Keynes's political economy would see a major reform in the international monetary system. Do you know something? Between 2003 and 2009, measurable global reserves have increased from 2.6 trillion to 7.5 trillion, an average annual rate of increase of about 16% at a time when global GDP was growing at an annual rate of 4.4%. In 2003, global gold reserves amounted to 7% of total reserves. In 2009, gold reserves had moved from 3% to 12%, 7% to 12%. 63%, of course, of international reserves are held in US dollars. And this flight into liquidity amounts to a large increase in deflationary pressure. Reserves are a way of insuring against uncertainty, and what is required is to lower the cost of insurance by reducing uncertainty. A package of measures to achieve this, very much in the Keynesian spirit, would need to include internationalization or diversification of reserves, control of hot money flows, whether by Tobin taxes or other or quantitative restrictions, and agreement on exchange rates. There's a huge agenda, and we haven't really begun it yet. But Keynes was convinced that unless the international monetary system was fixed, free trade would languish and globalization would go into reverse. And that, if we don't fix it, that will happen. Now my last topic. What about economics? Let's start with what sort of theory was Keynes's theory? He claimed his theory was more general than classical economics because it encompassed a variety of economic situations which all exhibit different states of knowledge. The question is, how central is the Keynes case? If the capitalist growth engine is subject to genuine ontological indeterminacy, then its mediocre performance and frequent breakdowns are explained. If, on the other hand, uncertainty can plausibly be modelled as an information problem to be overcome by learning and by more efficient data processing, then Keynes's case is the marginal case, and the classical case is reinstated as the central case. The comeback of classical economics has consisted in marginalizing Keynes's case and reinserting its own theory of the self-regulating market based on perfect information as the general case. Of course, it's not you know, there'll be deviations from it, but that is the general case for theorizing. The breakdown of the self-regulating market in 2007-08 suggests to me that Keynes's theory is the more general theory. But what would an economics that takes uncertainty seriously look like? Well, I can't go into that. That's another subject for another lecture, but I'd make one point. The fundamental issue involves the role of maths in economics. The older generation of economists used maths for a strictly limited purpose, to make more precise their intuitions about the real world, not to create an axiomatic system whose very virtue lay in its unrealism. There has to be a return to an economics which allows room for important observations of economic behavior which cannot be expressed in mathematical terms. Keynes himself was hostile to exaggerated precision. Whether or not he was the author of the phrase, "it's better to be vaguely right than precisely wrong," I don't know, but that was his sentiment. And there is a huge agenda here, which encompasses how to teach economics, in other words, what to do about the tripos, if one is really serious about reform, the production of economic textbooks, the reform of professional standards in economic journals, and a whole set of issues. All I can say is that, and it's public knowledge, so I don't, it's not private, George Soros has allocated $50 million to just this project, and it's going to be launched in Cambridge at King's College early in April. Now, conclusion. One clear conclusion emerges from this discussion. That is the need for a greater role for government in the management of the economy. A role, of course, which has to be made consistent with a change situation of a globalized economy, and that's difficult. A greater role for government, in turn, requires the intellectual rehabilitation of the state as a potentially rational economic actor, rather than as a mere vote seeker. And all our political science, which of course has been heavily influenced by new classical theory of economics, now sees politicians purely in terms of individual maximization of utilities. Public interest, that's out. And it's been decades since anyone was able to write, as Keynes did in 1936, of the state being in a position to calculate the marginal efficiency of capital goods on long views and on the basis of the general social advantage. Who can say that about government today? But we need to start to be able to say that. We need to think about a structure of the state which allows its investment function to be separated from the short-term political incentives facing politicians. And that's a big intellectual challenge to do that, and it's probably got to be done on a supranational level, or at least on a European level, as far as this country is concerned. So, we don't need a new Keynes. We do need the old Keynes, suitably updated. He will not be our sole guide to the economic future, but he remains an indispensable guide.
Well, thank you very much, Lord Skidelsky, for that lucid and slightly provocative presentation. I think you're now willing to take some questions from the floor?
Sure.
Yep. So could I ask you to wait for the microphone to be brought to you, and to also to state who you are when I invite you to put a question. And I must insist on questions or short comments. We only have one lecture scheduled here tonight. So if my ushers could bring down a microphone, and I'll take some...
Should I try to answer them in groups of three, or two or something?
Sure.
Because otherwise I want the tendencies to ramble and answer.
Okay.
And stuff.
I'll take two or three at a time.
Mm-hmm. and there aren't any.
So, Professor Brown, Professor William Brown, behind you.
That was really fascinating. I'm the wrong person to ask questions about macroeconomics, but I must ask you how we should reform the economics tripos. Or just to give some idea as to what you'd chuck out and what you'd put in.
Shall I take that? Or would you like another one first? You know, there's no agreement on content. That's the trouble. But what you can do, I think, are two things. First of all, I think you can reduce the weight of math in the judgment of the quality. In other words, I think it should. I think its weight in your overall degree should be reduced. And secondly, you could surround the core macro, micro, with compulsory other subjects. Now, I believe that is done already in part one here. But I mean, in many universities, you know, all the other things are sort of optional. There's hardly any economic history. There's no compulsion to do the history of economic thought. You can do a bit of politics. You can do a bit of sociology, but you're often advised by your directors of study, I'm using Cambridge terms here, that would not be the best preparation for, you know, further degree, postgraduate work. And I think that's the best that one can do at this point. I'm always a PPE person. I like the PPE degree. I think it's been dislodged from its original intentions, but I think it can still be valuable. I would like philosophy to be very, very important because, I mean, the validity of econometrics depends on philosophical conceptions. I mean, we all know the story, or do we, of the chicken who went every day to the hand that fed it until one day that hand wrung its neck, and hence a very classic illustration of the fallacy of the inductive principle. But in fact, most of our simple econometrics are based on induction. And that's why things so often go wrong. So I think I would put philosophy there. I would try to reduce the content of maths, reduce the weighting of maths in the judgment of the quality of the student, and also surround the subject by others. Now, that means reducing some of the content, undoubtedly. But we have no agreement on what content, really, should form a new macro, if you like, which I'm particularly interested in, and of course a new micro.
Yes, could we have this gentleman here?
David Lane, you spoke about the importance of having a greater socialization of investment, and at the end you talked about the rehabilitation of the state. But as you rightly pointed out, Keynes wasn't in favor of nationalization. What kind of instruments do you see the state having, and do you see a case now for greater nationalization?
That's a difficult one. I must say, at the beginning of the crisis, I thought the banks got off very, very lightly. I would have probably at that point been in favour of the nationalisation of the Royal Bank of Scotland and banks that had received huge, huge, huge government bailouts. I'm not sure I was right. I would have been right. I don't honestly think that. I think anything that nationalisation did well could probably be done by other means now. But nevertheless, I think that there's a huge area still to be explored in the area of public-private collaboration. I don't think Keynes would have been dogmatic. He wasn't dogmatic about this. Socialization was a sort of odd phrase which comes out of, one doesn't really understand the context of socialization as it comes in chapter 24 of the General Theory, unless one's gone through all the stuff he was writing in the 1920s before he had a General Theory. It was all about the evolution of capitalism and the idea that sort of private institutions, as they got larger, started to be more removed from profit maximization. And Galbraith wrote a book about this, The New Industrial State. It's turned out to be wrong in some respects. But on the other hand, there has been a huge concentration of global corporations and global corporate power. And we must find some way of reinstating a countervailing force somewhere there. Because otherwise, these people become too arrogant, too powerful, too complacent, and they screw the rest of us. I mean, one's got to, and the state is the only mechanism that can stand up to them. I mean, the trade unions have been emasculated by the change in the structure of the economy and by deliberate policy, of course. So that's what I'm really after. And I haven't got, I can't answer your question directly as I would like to, but I've given you my general approach.
Well, like the younger people here to know that I learned more about Keynes tonight than I did in four decades of economics in Cambridge. And for that, thank you. In particular, the distinction between uncertainty and risk, plus the impossibility of measuring risk in economics. That, I think, has been a bit lost here in the last 30 years. The question I'd like to ask is, what reasons do you have for thinking that the next decade in Britain will be different from the last two decades in Japan?
Not much. Not much. I'm very much a sort of a Krugmanite on this. I think Mervyn King and also Ben Bernanke have placed too much faith in quantitative easing, and not enough in the fiscal part. I think there's got. I mean, it's considered a great triumph. The newspapers of, as far as the United Kingdom is concerned, that in the last quarter, subject to statistical error, of course, our economy finally embarked on a vigorous rate of growth of 0.1%. And, this is not the kind of recovery one expects from the injection of several hundred billions of pounds over the last year or more into the economy. So there is a slip twixt cup and lip, as Keynes put it. And I think now the good side is that it takes time for fiscal policy to get working, but there are big infrastructure projects which are in train, and they should do something. They should do something to lift the great rate of growth. Also, there's been some devaluation of the pound. I mean, and that will be stimulating. So things should get better, but I think it's still very fraught. I mean, China and India have resumed a good rate of growth, but they're not yet big enough as economies to pull the world, to act as a locomotive for the whole world. And I think Europe and the United States, and Europe including the UK, are still quite stagnant. and one has to hope it'll get better. But at the moment, I don't think there's any real case for raving optimism about what the next year is going to bring.
Jeff? I only see him, but there may be others. He always asks a tricky question.
Jeff Harcourt, formerly of the faculty. How would you tackle a disease which I think has been taking over politicians of the conservative sort since the 70s, namely deficit size fetishism? And secondly, how would you get it across to people who are worried about the rise in the national debt versus relative to the national income, that there's a world of difference between internal debt, which is a redistribution between citizens, which you may not approve of the subsequent distribution, but it's within the country, and external debt, which ultimately will have has a real burden because you have to have higher exports in order to service it than you otherwise would have had.
Yeah, well, you see, I suppose they would say, okay, we'll get to some extent, we'll get the larger exports through the lower value of sterling. I think this deficit fetishism, there's a political route, okay, they're partly doing it just for political opportunism. But I think there's also a kind of reaction to what they thought was going on in the 1970s and to the excesses of Keynesianism. Deficit finance, they thought, was really what got us into trouble. And I suppose the model in their minds, if you credit them with having a model in their minds, the model in their minds is surely this, that in the 1960s and 70s, the governments were running deficits in order to maintain unemployment lower than its natural rate, right? And as a result, you got inflation. And then stagflation went along with it because they weren't attending to the supply side of the economy at all. And so the idea is, the model implicitly is that we're at full employment. That's the only explanation. And I've tackled George Osborne about this, and he slips away from it. He immediately starts talking about the impact of on the bond market. And he says, you know, governments, the markets don't have confidence in this. Well, so what? I mean, you know, why should one think the markets get these things right? I mean, with the record of 2007-08, one would have thought, you know, the government would have considerable intellectual firepower in resisting those kinds of arguments. But the idea that the economy is at full employment is crucial. And if it isn't, that's the fallback position, then quantitative easing will do all that you need to do. And you should not, you shouldn't enlarge your fiscal deficit. It's very, very hard. I have tried, but the only thing is, when I get into this sort of argument, I say we're not at full employment. And everything you say would be absolutely right, absolutely correct, if we're not at full employment. Second point, as we recover, the budget deficit, a part of it, will automatically shrink. And the national debt will automatically shrink insofar as we get back to a balanced budget position. So that we don't have to somehow have heroic efforts at rescuing an unsound fiscal position, because some of the so-called unsound fiscal position is a very sound fiscal position in the present circumstances. Now, it is also true that I don't think Gordon Brown's management of the Exchequer before the crisis struck is a sterling example of prudence. And we entered the recession with a deficit, a substantial deficit, about 2.5% of GDP, 3%, which shouldn't have been there at that stage in the cycle, I don't think, and certainly not according to his rules. So he fiddled the cycle in order to avoid balancing the budget over the cycle. He just changed the dates. And I think that was a mistake, and I think that's given the government a worse position with the markets than it would have had it. All these things are deeply psychological, as Keynes understood perfectly well. And it's difficult once you've lost the confidence. And then there's, of course, added to that, been a loss of political confidence in this government. But still, even so, it can still borrow money very, very cheaply by historic standards. There's been a slight blip recently in the bond rate, but it's still quite cheap. And I don't think there's any crisis of confidence in the government's finance. But the deficit fetishes, it's a matter of economic theory.
Questions? Wrong way. Sorry,
was there one?
This way. Okay.
You save it outside my book.
I'm Ugo Mattei, a land economics scholar from the University of California and from the University of Torino. Thank you very much for a really very, very interesting lecture. I have a small question that is this one. Do you believe that the domain of economic possibilities is limited by this kind of pendulum that it seems to come out from your description between, you know, classicism and Keynesianism? Like, you know, classes Keynes, then neoclasses, then neo-Keynes, then perhaps a new wave of neoclassics and so on and so forth. And how is that quite limited picture to me compatible with an idea of a long-term sustainability of the economic system, you know, taking into consideration all the variables of imbalances between the different economies and the possibilities of unlimited growth in a limited planet?
Mm. Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, the first thing that strikes one is that the fact that you do have these cycles in economic theory is one of the main differences from one of the main things that distinguishes economics from natural sciences. I think in some natural sciences you have cycles, but not in physics. I mean, you know, on the whole, you know, one theory supersedes another, and the other theory is gone. It's just of historical interest. Whereas in economics, you do get the return of the other is always sort of there, and nothing disappears, and many of the debates are interminable. Second point is that I do think Partha Dasgupta, not Partha Dasgupta, he's the son, but his father wrote a very interesting book called Epochs or Phases of Economic Theory, I think, in which he shows how theory changes as the world changes in various ways, because you have new problems, new concerns. Even something like the marginalist revolution, which can be given a purely internalist explanation in terms of the mathematization of Ricardian economics, nevertheless, was a very easy way of finessing the problem of the labor theory of value, which of course had been, you know, at the center of the classical economics, and Marx then used it for his purposes. The third element, I think, which I am very, very interested in, is the relation between economics and economic theory and structures of power. I think this has an enormous effect. I think it's not that economists are paid by big business to say certain things. It's nothing like that. I mean, we're all independent scholars. We do the economics. We follow the truth where it leads us. And yet, The domain of what one can say is limited in various ways by the financing of economics, by funding, and by the climate of opinion created by the dominant forces in the society. And I think now our economies are dominated by finance. We have a financial economy, and the interests of the financial services sector does dominate the thinking of economics. The rise of financial economics, which is in many ways a crude application of much more abstract ideas, is very striking recently, and there are examples. I mean, a lot of these professors of finance, they actually run hedge funds. I mean, of course, they like to say things that they might hope to benefit from financially. Sometimes they, as we know, with long-term capital management, which was started by two Nobel Prize winners, you know, they make terrible mistakes by believing their own rubbish. But that's the area I would explore in trying to get a handle on your question, the relationship between ideas and interests, or economic theory and structures of power.
Can I encourage a question from one of the student members of the audience? I know it's... there he goes, up there. I think this will be the last question.
Thank you, Ivan Rajic, Enfield Development Studies. Well, this was obviously a lecture about Keynes, so there is a good reason we haven't mentioned the old institutionalist school, historical school, the Austrians, and Schumpeter, wherever you want to place him. But talking about reforming education and economics, do you feel that there is any danger of, even if we reintroduce Keynes, we'll still miss out on these enormous schools of thought and miss out on certain aspects which actually, say, power, you've mentioned it, they've dealt with. So do you see any chance of reintegrating them as well together with Keynes?
Yeah,
thank you.
Absolutely. I attach enormous importance to students of economics studying the history of economic thought. And the history of economic thought has many giants in it. And, I mean, Hayek, obviously, Schumpeter, the Austrians, the Swedes. One should really know about these things. They're not obsolete. So many even postgraduate students, all they ever read are the latest journals. Or of course, the models that their professors feed them with. I mean, they do not read about the history of their subject. And it is, in many ways, a glorious subject. I mean, it's a sort of one of the intellectual triumphs of the West, economics, even though I'm a great critic of it, as it now is. But, I mean, it was a huge achievement. And that so much of it is simply unknown and only gets filtered through some of these trivial formalisms is a tragedy. It's an intellectual impoverishment of our civilization. And so, I mean, I do feel quite passionate about this, as you may detect. So, no, yes, we should have Schumpeter, we should have Hayek. Schumpeter has profound insights. We should have Hyman Minsky, who also has been briefly revived. Now, of course, no one mentions him any longer after 6 months. But the point is, these people believed that there were instabilities in the system which weren't simply related to Keynesian uncertainty. So I think we need to have that. I can't say anything more. I agree with you.
Well, thank you for that question. That actually brought it to a very nice close, I think. Thank you all very much for coming and making this such an interesting evening. There are copies of Lord Skidelsky's book, Keynes, The Return of the Master, on sale in the foyer, and he's kindly agreed to sign copies for a few minutes if you'd like to get an autograph.
As many minutes as you like.
Finally.